Next case on our calendar today is A23-1154. Thushari Rangita Alahaparuma versus Commissioner of Public Safety. Parties will each have 15 minutes for your arguments. Primary argument, appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium is adjustable, so feel free to adjust it up and down. And you'll have also see a clock on the podium that will tell you the amount of time you have left for your argument. We would appreciate it if counsel could introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument, and also help us out with any name pronunciations. Thank you. You can, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Class, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Thushari Alahaparuma, in this matter. We have previously filed a brief which outlines 3 issues. I would like to touch on all 3 issues today, but before I do that, I would like to clarify the issue of standard of review for the court. In respondent's brief, they did bring up an issue with respect to the standard of review with respect to all 3 issues. We are in agreement that the standard that is to be applied to all 3 issues is clear error, whether or not the district court did err on these decisions that they made at the district court level. Moving to the 3 issues at hand, the first issue that was raised was whether or not the district court erred with respect to finding that probable cause existed to arrest the appellant in this case. The district court based this finding on a number of factors. Most important for the issue before the court today are the factors of bloodshot eyes, slurred speech, and the smell of alcohol. In our brief and at the district court level, the argument was raised that there was video evidence which showed exactly what occurred at the time of arrest. In this situation, when reviewing the video, starting with appellant's eyes or lack of bloodshot eyes, you see them in the video. This was shown to the district court. This was evidence that was available to the officer that testified. This was his own evidence. And this was something that ultimately was a part of the record. Now, the officer that testified and handled the arrest, of course, testified to the opposite. He testified that there were bloodshot eyes. He testified that speech was slurred. And he testified that there was a smell of alcohol. Ultimately, in this case, the district court erred by ignoring the results of this video. We live in a modern technological age. These videos, in this case it was a body camera, are very clear. This is not a grainy surveillance video footage that you have to zoom in or try to enhance in order to get clarity.
But doesn't it have to,
go ahead.
Doesn't the video have to have an extremely fine resolution in order to see small little red lines on a white eyeball? I mean, isn't that unrealistic for a body-worn camera and when a person is, you know, at some distance from the officer? And I think the officer testified to that effect, right? The benefits of being in person versus watching a video.
In this case, the driver was right in front of the body camera during what we're talking about here. And can videos always be better in terms of their potential ability to see fine details? That's possible. But when we're talking about bloodshot and watery eyes as a sign of impairment, we're not talking about maybe a fine red line. A bloodshot eye is a bloodshot eye. It is a red eye. If it was just a fine red line that the officer was using to base their decision to arrest on, well, the argument may be raised at that point that it wasn't enough to arrest, or at least that one indicia of impairment wouldn't have been enough, because I don't think that would have even have been actual bloodshot eyes for the sake of impairment. In this situation,
counsel, before we get to the details of the probable cause, what significance, if any, is there that your client arguably was fleeing the officer?
Well, ultimately, whether or not she was fleeing in this case doesn't have any relevance to the implied consent question that we're being asked. In order to give the breath test to invoke the implied consent law, there has to be probable cause for arrest of a DWI. If you were arrested for another crime, such as felony flee in this situation, those arrest factors, even if justified, wouldn't actually invoke the implied consent law.
She wasn't charged with fleeing.
Your Honor, she was, but that case was subsequently dismissed.
Okay.
So in the district court's order, the district court notes that Trooper Miller explained during the hearing that he is most accurately able to assess whether someone is impaired during a live face-to-face encounter because all of his senses are engaged. The court finds this explanation credible. And doesn't our case law suggest that we defer to the district court's credibility determinations?
That is true, Your Honor, and we do acknowledge that. However, the distinguishing factor here is we have a situation where even though the district court has made that finding, we have evidence, good evidence, that does directly contradict the officer's testimony in this case. And I think that is the main crux of this first issue, is yes, discretion is given to a district court when they are making credibility determinations. We are also allowed to ultimately review those determinations. And at least from my perspective, very rarely do I feel that we are in a position, whether it's the criminal world or the implied consent world, where you have an officer testifying to one thing and his own body camera evidence may call into question a number of important factors that without those factors wouldn't actually justify arrest.
Well, even if we set aside the bloodshot eyes and the slurred speech, the trooper also testified to a strong smell of alcohol coming from petitioner's person during the interaction. And the case law also suggests that an officer need only one indicia of impairment to, that there needs only to be one indicia of impairment to support a probable cause determination.
Two issues with respect to that. First, if the officer is believed to be lacking credibility with respect to these other two factors, the district court should have made the finding that this was a witness that lacked credibility as to his whole testimony. If we accept the argument I just made with respect to bloodshot, watery eyes, slurred speech, and he lacks credibility on those points, well, he should lack credibility on this third point. Also, this issue of smell of alcohol, as addressed in our initial brief, does fall under this same category of lacking credibility. The smell of alcohol was addressed on camera. The smell of alcohol ultimately had the main arresting officer speaking to his partner, asking the partner whether or not he smelled anything. And ultimately, there was no response to that. There was some discussion later on, post-arrest at that point, that alcohol was smelled when she was inside the squad car. But we would still argue that the issue of smell of alcohol, finding that that was a valid factor to consider in probable cause, lacked credibility. But even if maybe that one factor was found to be credible, if he lacks credibility in the first two factors, this is a non-credible witness and his testimony should be disregarded at that point. Moving to our second issue, whether or not, in this case, the driver appellant actually refused the breath test and whether or not the district court erred. The respondent in their brief focuses on the fact that the cases cited, Johnson and Genia, deal with an officer interfering with the first initial testing window, and that that is ultimately the relevant factor that distinguishes that case from the issue we have here today. Ultimately, Johnson, Genia, Huber, Cole even, stands for the principle that at the end of the day, a driver should not be dependent on an officer's whim to interfere with the testing procedure before the timing window has ended. In this case, we had a first test, and then the second test was what was interfered with. That interference in the second test is the exact same as the interference with the first test in these other cases that have been cited.
And just to be clear, counsel, you're talking about what is the nature of the interference? Tell me.
Ending the test in this case. Yeah. Telling the tester you are done.
With 10 seconds left.
Right? That's correct. Yes. In these other cases,
am I correct? Would you agree that at that time, the appellant was not blowing? She had stopped blowing? I think maybe perhaps even taken her mouth off of the tube?
I would not agree with that, Your Honor. In our reply brief, we do focus on the breath test readout that was entered at the hearing, and we cite Netland, which speaks to the fact that if there are dotted lines within the test readout, it at least establishes that there was a breath being given. So we are not conceding that she was not participating in the test. In fact, I believe that the evidence shows there was an effort being made in this case.
Well, I think that she was blowing, you know, intermittently throughout that, I think, 3-minute period. But as I recall from watching the video, she stopped, and then the officer said, the machine is about to time out. And then, you know, I think there was only, given her lack of progress thus far, I think the officer saw there was no opportunity for her to finish within the 3-minute period. And that's what he did. But is that a fair characterization, do you think?
Factually, yes. But in terms of its relevance to this case, I would say that's really not what's important. We are maintaining that at the end of the day, these cases stand for the principle that if the testing window is 3 minutes, they are allowed to have those 3 minutes. And had she continued breathing for the last 10 seconds, I don't believe we have testimony, and I can't speak to what the result would have been, whether or not it would have been an appropriate test, or ultimately what the results would have been. But that is why these cases are speaking to not having a driver be subject to ultimately the subjectivity of an officer in this case in making those judgment calls before a testing period is over.
Counsel, I heard, if I understood you right, when you were citing cases, you said even Cole. How does Cole help you?
Well, Your Honor, Cole still, I believe, speaks to this general principle of the officer not overly interfering with the testing process. The conduct in Cole by the driver seemed extreme. Cole also was given 3 opportunities to test in that case, and Cole is factually distinguishable because the real complaint from the driver at that point was that his testing process was delayed or interfered with basically because of an equipment issue, not because of the officer just deeming, okay, you're finished at this point and cutting it short. I see I have 2 minutes left here. I do wish to quickly move on to the third issue, which is respect to whether or not she actually was entitled to and asked for an independent test. The first issue here is whether or not, even if she had, in the court's eyes, asked for an independent test in an appropriate way, whether or not she was even entitled to that. Case law says that if a person refuses, they're not entitled to be given an independent test. The answer to this, from our perspective, is see argument 2. Because in argument 2, we are saying she did not refuse. This was not a valid refusal. And so any subsequent asking for an independent test still would be valid. We are arguing that the officer was wrong in deeming her conduct a refusal. In a situation where the officer is wrong when calling something a refusal, that should not negate the driver's right to ultimately having the ability to ask for the independent test. Finally, the language that was used was appropriate. I cite Thiel in this case because the language in that case was a second test and another test. Here we have the driver asking, can I do it again? Can I do another one in there? Implying to another room. And can I take another one, sir? Those terms, the language that is used is sufficiently similar to Thiel. And ultimately, she was entitled to an independent test, and she did use the appropriate language to tell the officer that she wanted that independent test. This was a very, very stressful situation for my client. Throughout the entire arrest, testing, and then booking process, you can see that she is in a state of panic, that she is in a state of fear, and that this is ultimately overwhelming, to say the least. All of that contributes to this. We ask that you find on each three of these issues that the district court has erred in making its findings and that you reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Good morning. You can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Madeline Sheehy. I'm here today representing the respondent in this case, the Commissioner of Public Safety. There are three issues presented in this case. The first is whether the officer had probable cause to arrest the appellant for driving while impaired based on her driving conduct and the indicia of impairment he observed. The second is whether appellant refused the test. And the third is whether any right to an independent test was violated. Because the district court's factual findings in this case were not clearly erroneous and well supported by the record, this court should affirm. First, to touch upon the probable cause argument, I would like to address some of the questions that were asked by the court during appellant's argument. I think the driving conduct in this case is certainly relevant to a probable cause determination to arrest for DWI. The appellant was speeding significantly. The testimony was about 70 miles per hour at one point in a 45, in a 40, 63 in a 45, 70 once she continued on to 394, weaving significantly over lane lines to the point where if there was a vehicle in the lane next to her, that there would have been an accident, and failing to stop for a state trooper with lights and sirens activated for nearly a mile and a half. That's significant driving conduct that's indicative to impairment and supports a probable cause determination in this case, which the district court considered and found.
Ms. Sheehy, am I correct that for much of that stretch of 394 right before 100, there really isn't a shoulder? I mean, was she expected to stop with perhaps half her vehicle in the lane of traffic? Was there testimony about that at the hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, there was testimony about that. And the trooper in this case specifically testified that he waited until the shoulder opened up right about Theodore Worth Parkway to turn on his lights to initiate a stop, because that's where the shoulder opened up. The trooper also testified that he's made other stops in that area of 394 before, and that there had been no similar issue with continuing driving.
Is there a full shoulder? So somebody could pull over and have their car on the right side of the white line?
I don't believe there's testimony about how wide the shoulder was at that point, but the trooper did testify that he specifically waited to turn on his lights to make a stop at that point because it is where the shoulder opened up.
Thank you.
I would also like to touch on the district court's credibility determinations in this case. There was a lot of evidence in this case. For a standard DWI case, there was approximately 2 hours of video. The district court did not ignore that video. The district court reviewed that video and evaluated it in combination with the other evidence, including the testimony of the trooper, which the district court repeatedly found trustworthy, credible, and reliable.
Counsel, the appellant argues that even though the district court found the trooper to be credible, that that testimony is contradicted by the video and that the district court's factual findings are clearly erroneous, or at least that's my understanding of the argument. Does the video support the argument that the district court's factual findings are clearly erroneous?
No, Your Honor, it does not. The district court, in its order, found that the video did not contradict the trooper's testimony, relying in part on the trooper's testimony that he is most accurately able to assess impairment during a live face-to-face encounter. I think certainly when you're talking about the strength of an odor of alcohol, that's not something that a district court can assess from a video, like a trooper may be able to during a close encounter with the driver at the roadside.
You heard appellant's argument, though, that the video didn't show bloodshot, watery eyes, and if the district court erred in that finding, then this court should conclude that the witness wasn't credible and the district court's credibility determination isn't supported by the record.
I disagree that the district court's credibility determination is not supported by the record. The district court found that the trooper's testimony about bloodshot, watery eyes was not contradicted by the video. I think to Judge Johnson's questions about whether you can truly see a red line in someone's eye or redness in someone's eyes at night through a body camera video, there was a lot going on in this case. I think that's certainly relevant. I also would note that the district court referenced the officer's training. This trooper had significant training in assessing indicators of impairment in people. Because that officer has training, he might be able to more accurately assess whether someone's eyes are bloodshot and watery than even lawyers and judges can when watching a district court video. And that was an important component of the district court's credibility determination in this case. I would also just note, since your question was specific to the bloodshot, watery eyes, even if that indicator of impairment was thrown out, I would submit that there is ample probable cause to arrest for DWI in this case based on the driving conduct, the strong odor of alcohol, and the slurred speech. I'll next move to appellant's argument about breath test refusal. The district court's finding in this case that appellant's behavior, specifically the breathing conduct, frustrated the testing process is well supported by the record and not clearly erroneous. I understand that we're in agreement about the standard of review. Whether someone refused a test authorized by the implied consent law, in this case a breath test, is a question of fact. And then on appeal, the question presented is whether such findings are supported by the evidence. That's from State Department of Highways versus Becky, Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1971. Here, the trooper provided the appellant with ample opportunities to provide a sample, and that's what makes this case so substantially different from Jenia Johnson and the other cases cited by a respondent. I also think it's important to note that in the statute, there's a difference between an adequate breath sample and a deficient breath test. The statute, which is Section 169A.51, Subdivision 5, B, in the case of a test administered using an infrared or other breath testing instrument, a sample is adequate if the instrument analyzes the sample and does not indicate the sample is deficient. We have a deficient sample here. If you look at Respondent's Exhibit C from the district court, the appellant was given an opportunity to provide an adequate sample. The machine ran through all its checks. There's no allegation that it wasn't working properly. The machine determined the adequacy of the sample. The sample was deficient.
Any, testimony about whether if she had had the additional 10 seconds, she could have provided an adequate sample in that 10 seconds?
There's some limited testimony. I would direct the court to page 37, lines 17 to 23 of the transcript. The trooper testified there that, I'm going to quote from it, she was probably 10 seconds away from the 3 minutes, and she let out. She released. Stopped blowing into the machine again. It went back down to no air in the machine. At that point, based on my training, there was no way to give a sample at that point. I told her, we're done with the testing.
And am I correct that she would have needed 2 samples?
Yes, Your Honor. In order to, and going back to the statutory definition of what an adequate breath test is, it requires 2 adequate samples run. So a driver gives 1 breath sample, and then the machine goes through some checks, and then a driver gives another sample. The machine takes the lower of the 2 samples, cutting the 3rd digit, and that's the final result.
And at that point, she had 0. So I guess the question maybe is whether she could have done 2 samples in those in the 10 seconds. Is that?
Well, that 10-second window was to provide the first sample. So she would have had to then do, if it ended with a deficient sample, though, then that would be it for the test.
If she had done 1 adequate sample in those last 10 seconds, then would she have had another 3-minute opportunity for a second sample?
Hypothetically, if appellant had provided, if during that 3-minute sample window there had been an adequate sample, then there would be another opportunity to provide another one, and you would, yes, the machine requires 2.
And remind me again, please, did she have 1 3-minute period, or was she given 1 3-minute period, or was she given 2 3-minute periods?
So she was previously given a full 3-minute period during the first attempt at testing. The trooper started up the machine, gave the appellant the mouthpiece, told her instructions, make a tight seal around the mouthpiece, strong, steady breath, coached her through the process. There's no allegation that he took the mouthpiece away during that 3-minute time period, and appellant provided a deficient sample. That is Exhibit C, Respondent's Exhibit C in the trial court records.
In the Farrier case, I think this court referred to evidence that the driver was not engaging in good faith, I think was the term we used, and I think we probably were adopting that term from the district court in that case. In other words, there seemed to be a judgment by the fact finder that the driver was not making a real attempt, you know, that was perhaps, I don't know, faking it or something. But I don't think, we don't have that kind of a finding in this case, I don't think. I mean, on page 9, the district court writes, Trooper Miller testified that he believed petitioner was acting to frustrate the breath test by not following directions and failing to provide a sufficient sample. Further down, he did not believe she was blowing at all. I guess, do we treat that as equivalent to the evidence in Farrier, or is this different?
So I'd like to clarify specifically on Farrier. Farrier was a urine sample case.
That's right, it was. I think my question still.
I agree. I think that determination is relevant. But I do think the district courts on page 9 and going to page 10 as you were reading, I think the district court did make the determination that petitioner had access for a full sample window in all but 10 seconds and therefore had a reasonable opportunity to provide a sample. The court finds the observation of Trooper Miller trustworthy and compelling and deems petitioner's failure to provide a sample an implied refusal of the test. That's on page 10 of the district court's order. So I do think the district court did make findings regarding the good faith effort or whatever the language was in Farrier that you referenced.
I guess, in other words, do you think Farrier applies?
I think Farrier is a urine test case, but I do think that the case law indicates that other than verbally agreeing to provide a breath sample, drivers have an obligation not to frustrate the testing process. And that's in Connolly, which is cited in our brief as well. Connolly, which is a breath testing case, addressed identical conduct to this, where an officer noticed that the driver was starting and stopping, not providing a full, long, steady breath into the instrument, and determined that he had refused the test. I think that's analogous to here and speaks to the conduct that was at issue here.
Does the language in Genia about allowing the full time period suggest that you can't have a refusal if the person isn't given the full time period?
So I believe that...
And specifically I'm looking at the language that talks about allowing the intoxilizer to determine the adequacy of the sample by providing, in that case, it was a full 4 minute period.
Yes, Your Honor. The concern in Genia in those other cases, which is a valid concern, is that the officer is inhibiting a driver's ability to provide their one chance to provide a breath sample. In Genia and in Johnson, Johnson was the case where the driver was being argumentative throughout the process, and then right before he tried to blow into the machine, stuck his tongue out at the officer. And the officer just said, "You're done." That's not what happened here. This officer gave the appellant what was required under Johnson and Genia. She had a full opportunity to provide an adequate breath sample. He let her try again. He gave her a full 2 minutes and 50 seconds of the 3 minute sample window to provide another sample. Despite that, which I would say under Cole is a, if Cole 60 seconds of access to the mouthpiece was a reasonable opportunity to provide a sample, 2 minutes and 50 seconds of a 3 minute sample window here is definitely a reasonable opportunity to provide a sample. So I think when you look at the case law together, including Jenny and Johnson and Cole, this case is distinguishable. First, because the appellant had an opportunity to provide a full sample previously, and second, because this was only 10 seconds before the end of the sample window, and that was not as significant an interruption as in the other cited cases by respondent.
I think the district court had two bases for tell me if you agree or disagree. I think the district court had two legal bases for finding refusal. One was simply the fact that she was not cooperating. Then the second was the statute, subdivision 5C. Do Genia and Cole apply to the first or the second or both?
I would note that my time is up, Your Honor. May I answer the question?
You may.
Thank you. The statute, 169A.51, subdivision B, is what lays out the definition for an adequate sample. A sample is adequate if the instrument analyzes the sample and does not indicate the sample is deficient. In Genia, in that line of cases, the focus is on the fact that the machine did not go through its internal processes to determine the adequacy of the sample. There's multiple references to the machine didn't do a calibration check, which at the time of the intoxilizer was required. It happened after the first breath sample and gave the indication that the machine was properly functioning. That's not the concern we have here. We know that this DMT was functioning because of that previous attempt at a sample. So I think that's what that is where Genia applies. I would just finish by asking this court to affirm the district court's order sustaining the license revocation in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you. First, I would like to address this issue of the driving conduct and how that does apply to the probable cause determination here. There are times when a driver's conduct does contribute to a DWI probable cause determination. A driver is swerving. A driver is maybe going significantly below the speed limit. A driver maybe is weaving in and out very erratically or something within the weaving type argument. That's not what we have here. The driving conduct was speeding. Speeding is a crime that occurs frequently, And then also this allegation as to whether or not she actually was engaging in fleeing once the driver or the officer saw that she was speeding. If we had actual weaving conduct, touching of lanes, things like that, that would be driving conduct that is directly connected to a person consuming alcohol. There are plenty of people in this state that are charged with the crime of speeding and charged with a felony flee in a motor vehicle that are not subsequently charged with a DWI in this case. And I think that is the important distinction when we're talking about driving conduct and how it may pertain to these other factors. We have what the officer believed was evidence of one crime that then lead to evidence of another crime, the DWI, and then the invocation of the implied consent. But the driving conduct here should not be considered in the totality of the circumstances as it applies to the officer's probable cause determination. The other factor that I'm not sure I touched on my initial argument here that was considered was the allegation of slurred speech. We talked about bloodshot, watery eyes, but slurred speech may be a better example of a factor that was cited by the officer, cited by the district court, that ultimately was seen or heard in this case on video. There is the argument that was brought up about how well can you see eyes and things like that. Well, audio is a completely different situation on these videos. Yes, it was on the side of the road. Yes, there was a lot going on. But this was not in the midst of some loud concert or some other loud intervening event. They were on the side of the road where people could be heard speaking clearly. I just bring up the slurred speech as a very clear-cut example of a factor that was cited that is not supported by the video evidence. During respondent's argument, the court brought up a number of the district court's findings with respect to what the officer said and how the officer testified to his training and how that pertained to a number of findings that he made. I think this case is a very good example of how district courts should treat officers' testimony in these cases. We know that in DWI-related situations, most of the time an officer is going to have some level of training. But if we really think about what that training is and how it applies here, it shouldn't be given the deference that it's been given. Every single person in this room can look at a person's eyes and determine whether or not they're bloodshot. Every person in this room can listen to a person speak and determine whether or not they're speaking in a slurred manner. Simply because an officer can claim that they have a baseline of training doesn't mean that a district court is always justified in ignoring a video that may contradict a number of the factors that the officer may say, my training justifies my testimony here, tells the court why my testimony is correct. But when we have a video, I don't know that basic testimony with respect to DWI training is enough to rebut that when we're reviewing a district court's decision. Very quickly here on the second issue, I do just want to address this issue of whether or not the district court made a finding of whether or not the driver in this case was acting in good faith. The words good faith were not used, and I think this really is the issue in this case, which is Genia Johnson and the cases that we have been cited speak to this idea that where a driver is actually acting in good faith or is not doing something physical to thwart the process, sticking their tongue out at the officer or engaging in some erratic behavior that prevents them from taking the test, we should let the driver ultimately finish the test-taking window, which was 3 minutes in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful briefs and arguments here today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the time frame.